So the perfect person wants to do the dirty work.
It's just a task, like, let's just get it done.
But they ask for the glamorous work.
You're listening to Your Financial Planner Now What, the podcast to help you fast track your career by bringing you meaningful conversations on topics that influence new financial planners, their careers, and the lives of their clients.
Today's guest is Brian Hassling, a CFP professional and senior financial planner at JW Harrison in sunny California. After just 5 years in the profession, Brian is on track to become a partner at the firm where he was the first hire. He credits this to his community, his network, and his tribe within the financial planning profession. Because of this, Brian is focused on helping other financial planners foster community in the FPA and lift one another up for success. Straight ahead, Brian shares how financial planners can build career paths, foster success, and grow together.
When you think about the work of financial planners, do you think of words like passion, purpose, and impact? If not, then something just isn't right. I'm Kate Healy, Managing Director of Generation Next at TD Ameritrade, and we believe that empowering people to live their best lives is a noble calling. The independent RIAs who work with us use their passion to help transform client lives, communities, and their own futures. Want to learn more about how we can support you in helping your clients reach their financial goals? Find out more at tdainstitutional.com.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Brian.
Happy to be here.
So you have seen a lot of success in your financial planning career, and we were going to dive into all of that. But how did you first get into financial planning?
Yeah, so I was one of the lucky people who stumbled into this whole industry, which is turns out to be, at least if you're in your early 20s, it seems to be a pretty common path. Because what happens, like I was 18 years old and I went to college and then I was supposed to pick a major. And I don't know what I'm supposed to major in, maybe like accounting or something, and maybe some economics classes. And I take those and they don't really work out. And I sort of dance around until the point where I happened to go to a college that actually formally taught financial planning. So I ended up getting recommended over there and I take it and it starts to resonate with me. So I was basically like years into college before I even found it. So I just kind of fumbled around until I found financial planning. And then once you find it, it's like, what's important is why you stick around. I realized I've seen some of this stuff before. And it was kind of some of the stuff that I was helping my own family with. So my parents went through a divorce like a few years prior to my first financial planning class. So I was basically helping some of my family out, mainly my mom with like financial planning topics, I guess you could say. In a divorce, like money gets moved around, the new accounts need to get opened, and you learn what a quadro is for the first time. So just all that stuff, I had seen some of the stuff in my classes in real life, and I was like, I think this is it. So I ended up getting lucky and just sort of like stumbling into it. But no 18-year-old really goes into college like wanting to be a financial planner because they don't know what it is.
Hopefully we're going to change that in our lifetime, but
yes.
So you find this financial planning degree and like you've seen some of this, you know, in your own family. Was that kind of the moment you were like, this is what I'm going to do? Or was it kind of more gradual?
Yeah, it was. That's a really good question. So it was pretty gradual. When you're in college and you're just like taking classes and you're trying to like find your identity, like, what am I doing? Like, I found these classes, but like, am I going to do this? I don't really know. But like, I was familiar with some of the topics and I was kind of good at it. So I was like, I'll just stick around here for a while and see what happens. So it didn't happen immediately, but I was interested enough to stick around. And then I stuck around and I ended up hanging around the program and all of like their fun groups and clubs and things. And I started getting really, really involved with those people. So the best thing I did was decide to be really, really involved with the program. You know, it was kind of a small like boutique program. It wasn't even in the business college. It was in like the human sciences college because that was the only school that would take them. Like this really boutique like feel to it. We had our own corner of the building. We had our own computer lab. and the teachers, there wasn't that many of them, but because there's not that many of them, like you can talk to them and make relationships with them. So I just started hanging around more. I ended up becoming like an ambassador to the program. So I would like give people tours or just be like a face for the program. And you just get to do a lot of things when you're in a small program. Like I got to go to competitions and compete and represent the school. I got to go to conferences and wear our red shirts, because at Texas Tech, you have to wear like a blindingly red shirt when you go to a conference. So I got to be one of those people, which was a ton of fun. So the smartest thing I did, though, was just like allow myself to get involved with those people and make those people my friends. I think a lot of people that were like a lot of my classmates, you know, they went to class and then they checked out and they went to go hang out with their other friends. Me, I decided to like really commit and make these financial planning people my friends. So like a lot of them are still my best friends to this day. There's just, we had this little community going on, and you could be as involved or not as you wanted. So what ended up happening is that I basically, I don't know, I just found like a little tribe, and we just nerded out on financial planning stuff all day long. And you can make your, if you're a financial planner, you know that like you have like little inside jokes that only other financial planners get. So like I could make those jokes with these people, and we could vent about classes together, and you'd spend every waking moment together. And that's when it like clicked on. I was like, this is my people. Like they get me, we get each other, and this is who I want to be a part of.
Yep. Oh, I love that. And this idea of finding your people, like how important that is to a career, especially in the early stages of it.
Yeah, because I wouldn't consider myself like a, I wasn't like a naturally like overly gifted student. So like if I joined a community where it was very normal to do your homework and like, you know, do really good on your projects and present really cool stuff, like that was the normal, I joined that tribe. And so like invariably, like I just started like being a little bit more impressive when I was on my own, probably not that impressive.
You know, I love this. I don't know, even know who said it, but somebody somewhere says that you are like, look at the five people you're around the most, or the five types of people, if you would, that you're around. And that's who you are. And it's totally. Like, if you want to get better, surround yourself with people who are better than you, or, you know, who are where you want to be.
Yeah. I definitely learned how that was important, I think, in those college years. And I, even more recently, I've expanded on that five closest people to you definition. I just bought this book. I haven't read it yet. I'm like a chapter in, but I just, got this book by this author named James Clear. He writes this really like really cool like newsletter like once or twice a week, and he just writes about habits. Like the book is literally called Atomic Habits. Atomic meaning like really really small, like the smallest possible thing compounded over time results in like really cool stuff. If you want to make like a habit like really, really easy and a part of you, the easiest thing to do is just join a group of people who are doing something and working towards a common goal that you are. But the more important part isn't the common goal. The more important part is the behavior that is looked down upon in that little tribe, in that little culture. So like, what's an example? I've joined a running club before, because I wanted to like run more and exercise more. So I joined that little club, and like that was my tribe at the time. And yeah, we were all running far, but you like didn't need to be a fast runner. Like you just needed to run. So the behavior that was accepted was like, you have to at least be trying. And the behavior that was looked down upon was somebody being lazy. So by definition, like you didn't want to be lazy, or else you would be like essentially shunned from the group. You didn't have to be like an amazing athlete or anything. You just need to try. So that's like a really simple example of like what all these different tribes are doing. I think like XY Planning Network, like that's a huge, tribe, and everybody moves at different speeds. Some people's businesses are taking off. Some people's businesses are like forming way slower and they're kind of confused. But as long as they're still trying, they're in. And if they get lazy and like stop being involved, like that's kind of looked down upon, and nobody wants to be looked down upon.
So you're in college, you graduate. What was it like looking for your first job? Like what were your thought processes in finding and accepting a job?
When you go to an actual program that actually teaches this new age fee-only financial planning, you know, get you on the track to CFP ASAP, there's a lot of acronyms there. When you go to these programs, you start to realize like, whoa, I think I'm gonna have a job after college, and I think I'm gonna have more than one offer. At least that's like what they like plague your mind with. Like they basically like you walk into a class and they tell you that you're gonna have a job. So that's a really cool feeling. And so I realized like, well, I'm in my 20s. People in my family like are not accustomed to like the go build a career life. Like it's just not like something we did. But like I really wanted that. I really wanted to put my best foot forward and like be a career person and really get good at this and really just go all in. And I knew that if I wanted to do that, I had to create a little bit of separation from like my home base and just like get away from it all and just go all in. So I'm from Texas. I'm from Dallas. There's a ton of jobs in Dallas. Honestly, there's a lot of people who recruited from our school, and all those firms were in Dallas. And that's where most of the students go. And there's some really great firms that are there. So there were options there, but like, I knew that if I took a job in Dallas or Fort Worth, that I was going to be like around like, you know, who's there? Like my high school buddies. I have a lot of family around, but like, I don't need to see my family to be close to my family. I'm actually closer with my family when I don't live next to them, because we just like phone calls are so much more efficient for whatever reason. So I knew I didn't need to be like near and dear to my family just to be close with them. And you know, my high school buddies, I don't need to be close to them. We're playing different ball games now. So I basically wanted to go out of state, at least for a little bit. So I started thinking about places I wanted to work. And I really just started with geography. And I asked myself, where do I want to go? I ended up deciding that my criteria was I want to work in like a cool, like call it metropolitan area with a lot of like, you know, call it commerce, like a lot of business activity, maybe like a big city. So I want that just because I knew that there would be a lot of like job opportunity there. But I also wanted to work for preferably with nice people. And I ended up landing on the Bay Area. I think I landed on like, I don't know where else I landed. Like maybe like Southern California, like San Diego. I'm not sure what it was, but maybe DC was up there. But then I talked to like a recruiter guy and he was like, you don't want to work in DC either. Mean there. So I ended up landing on the Bay Area. And I was like, well, where do I find these jobs at? I didn't have any luck when I was talking with people at conferences. That's just kind of like hit or miss. But I did happen to know the main recruiter in our industry, which is Caleb Brown, because he also went to Texas Tech, and he was kind of a name that we all knew. And he had a couple of jobs in the Bay Area. So I contacted him and I said, hey, I want to apply to this firm in San Francisco. And he calls me like 30 minutes later and was like, are you serious about this, Brian? Like San Francisco, you're from Dallas. Like, be real with me. I was like, Caleb, I'm being serious. I want to do this. So we did the full like formal process, and he kind of vetted me, presented me to a few firms, ended up connecting with my current boss eventually. And I had a couple other offers at the time. So I had to choose like, well, what do I choose? I ended up choosing my current opportunity, even though it was the opportunity with the by far the greatest risk and like the lowest like amount of track record of success, because the firm was 3 years old at the time. I think on the AUM scale, I think we managed like 30 million at that point. And I was, my boss had never hired anybody before. It was his 3-year-old business and I was the first hire. So like that was inherently risky for sure, but I still ended up choosing it. And I chose it because number one, I wanted to be on the ground floor of something. Cause I wanted to be like, if I really went all in, I wanted to feel like I was important to the operation. So I was like, well, if I'm number two, then I have to be important. So like, I'm going to get a lot of work that way. So I want that. But also, when I was in the interview, I got the sense that my current boss was a very experienced manager. And his former career was basically like a manager of multiple levels at a corporation, where his main job was to just oversee people and grow them and make sure he was putting them in like a great place to be happy, you know, make good money and just like have like work satisfaction. I could sense that. I could tell that that was the kind of person he was, where he gave a lot of energy to the people he managed. So I could feel that. He made it very clear to me that this job would be highly tailored towards me and whatever I was wanting. And I had to take that opportunity.
So many questions. Okay.
Sorry.
Number one. No. It's so good. You know, it's so interesting. I think back to when I took my first job, mm-hmm. and the thought of, you know, the risk that was associated with accepting that, the jobs that I did accept, that didn't even cross my radar of, you know, was this a risky place to go work? And so it's yeah. really interesting to kind of hear that from your perspective of that, that's how you evaluated your job offers.
Well, you did the same sort of leap, right? Like in your, yeah. in your early 20s, right?
Yep, absolutely. And you know, for me, I mean, I love to say I had as much thought as you did, but it was really, oh, it's a job. Sure. I'll take it, you know? And so,
of course.
Yeah, I love this kind of different lens in which to view these job offers through.
It was definitely a risk. And my boss knew that. I mean, he knew that I was taking a risk. The other risk was like, I was moving from Texas to California. So like there's a flip right there already from a culture standpoint. And I didn't have any friends. I didn't have any family. I had nothing. So huge risk for me on that standpoint, and a huge risk for my boss at the same time, because if somebody doesn't have any like support network, they don't have any roots, well, then they can up and leave you just as quickly as they joined you. So we both kind of like had this like calculated risk that we were taking on each other. but we did it.
What was next for you? So you're working for this company. What did that look like? Or what was your next kind of progression in your career at that point?
So immediately upon getting started, of course you're learning like the job and you're getting introduced to like some clients, maybe, maybe not. But then comes the question of licensing. So actually before I had even started my first day, I decided to try and be that person who could knock out the CFP exam like before. So I said, hey, I told my boss like, hey, thanks for the job offer. I accept. Also, I'd like to not start immediately. I'd like to study for the CFP exam over the summer before I start. You know, I have plenty of free time. So that's what I did. So I studied. I took the CFP exam. I moved to California like a week or two later. And then I got my results, because this was the day where you had to wait for your results. It was like the last paper exam. So I'm like 2 weeks into like my new job, and I get an email from the CFP, and they're like,
congratulations, Brian, you failed the CFP exam.
So ouch.
I was like, no, I just moved across the country for this and I'm already failing. So that sucked. Basically, like, boss told me, like, you know, that this is bad, but just sign up. Like, give yourself a day to mope. Sure. But, like, sign up again and let's do this. So I signed up again. Here I am. I spent the first, like, 3 months of me living in, you know, sunshine in California, basically in the office studying for the CFP exam. So that was kind of a bummer. Also, while trying to learn the new job. So that was kind of a bummer. But then I took the exam again, and I passed that time, which, yeah, I mean, that was way better. But then, even so, passing, I didn't have the designation yet, because as basically everyone knows, you have to have years of work experience to get the credentials. So I didn't have that yet, right? I didn't have enough. I had some, I didn't have enough. But remember, I was hire number one and we were getting a bunch of clients coming in. And so I needed to be licensed to speak with them about financial stuff. So I ended up having to start studying again for this other exam called the Series 65. Series 65 is the one that allows you to give investment advice for a fee. Most people get this one if they don't have the CFP yet. If you have the CFP, if you have the CFP and you actually have the designation, you don't need to take the 65. But me, I needed to. So what happens there? I study for like another month. I'm kind of trapped in the office. But also, like, I just passed the CFP exam and I'm pretty cocky about it. So I didn't study that much. And then I classically failed that exam. And that was terrible. So that was terrible. And this was all like within like a few months of like moving here. So I'm just like failing all over the place. And then I signed up again and I took that one and then I passed it again. But that was the first several months. And I think that's probably the first several months for lots of new hires.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Some of the best planners I know have failed their CFP exam. Like, I do not think that's an indicator whatsoever of whether or not you're going to have a successful career. I mean, you do need to pass.
Yeah.
It is good to pass your CFP.
Please do. Yes.
Yeah. But, you know, it's encouraging to know that if people are failing their CFP exam and in the middle of that, there will be a day where you can look back. I don't know if maybe laugh at it or laugh about it, but it'll get better.
Yeah. It's at first it was embarrassing. You know, it's just like, crap, I told all these people I was taking this thing, you know, so now I have social shame. But also there's like the internal failure, like, crap, like, this is what I devoted my life to and I can't pass this exam. Like, who am I? You have this like identity crisis. And then you just sign up again and you learn how to master these exams. Like, they're kind of strange. Like, exams are not real life. You just have to like accept that as a part of life. It's just not, it has nothing to do with the job, like your ability to answer A, B, C, D. But it's just a part of it. So it's something we have to do.
As you're doing this, the first time I knew about you, I was online and I stumbled across this blog, the Millennial Planners blog. Can you tell me what is this and how did this get started?
Yeah, Millennial Planners. So that started, I think it started right after all this like exam stuff that I just described. Because like finally I had like free time. Yep. And you get done with your exam, you're like, wow, what am I going to do with all of my free time? You finally learn like, wow, this is what like time management looks like. This is amazing. When before you thought you had no time. So I had free time. And also what I had done was I tried to replicate that tribe mentality from back in college. Like, I needed a new sort of tribe. And I didn't know who my people were yet. You know, I wasn't sure who was trying to get good at this job in this industry like I was. And ended up finding a couple people and we made a study group. We basically like met up via video chat like once a month.
you know, one guy was like down the street from me, but the other guy was in like Connecticut. So like we just like did our video chat once a month where we sort of dove in like, what's going on? How you feeling about work? And it was kind of like a venting session, really. Not so much technical, just like how you feeling about work and how'd you get over this and hard times and happy times. So that's kind of what the social or the study group was. And we all ended up realizing that we like to write. I think they actually had a blog together like years prior just for fun. So like we wanted to write about like this very specific financial planning industry stuff. So we started writing. One of the guys, he reads so much and he like did like, I read this book and here's how it relates to financial planning and all this stuff. And me, I think my first post was like basically speaking to college Brian of how to get a job. Like if I was talking to former Brian, trying to help him out and trying to help him give like all the cheat codes, basically like how could I help him find a job? So I wrote like how to find a job in financial planning. And it was like, basically what was the punchline of the article? It was like, here's how you interview. Here's how you identify a firm. Here's what a form ADV is and where you can find it. Here is why you don't get the job offer sometimes, even though you thought you were perfect, and all sorts of stuff. So like just speaking to people who were just behind me, like the cohort that's just behind me, who's about to live the life that I'm living right now. What advice could I give them? So I think the next article I wrote was how to pass the CFP exam. And it was like a 12-week study guide. And I wrote that like 3 or 4 years ago. And I still get people from like across the country all the time that find it, because I guess nobody else is writing these things. So I'm just like getting hits all the time from it. And people saying, thank you so much for writing this. And yeah, I mean, you might have even saw that one from a long time ago. That was like a pretty popular one.
Well, this is a lot of work that you guys are putting into this blog. Like, what's your motivation for it? Like, why were you guys doing this?
I think we all had like different motivations. One guy, Joe, he just likes to document like his thoughts. Like he's a very like introspective person. He's the one that like reads and does book reports. He's very introspective. He likes to think on paper, basically. He's a really big journaler. So like, it's basically like, it was like his journal. My thing was like, I want to give advice to the people who are just behind me, because I'm a big brother at heart. I have a little brother and I want to make his life as easy as possible with everything that I just went through and interpreting all that, and just like making that life a little bit easier. And I wanted to do the same for people in this industry. It's so similar to what this podcast is about. Like, great, I got a job. So what do I do now? And how is this supposed to feel? Is this normal? And so it's really just like trying to let you know, like, hey, it's normal. Yep. And by the way, here's a couple tips on how you can like get over that hump, because I know it sucks.
You have this blog and you're working on this, and you became an enrolled agent as well. Is that right?
Yeah. So I ended up pursuing the IRS enrolled agent, which is basically like the CPA's like little tax cousin, basically. And I did that because number one, like I had that free time again, you know, like, what do I do? I need to like sign up for another exam. Cause once you take the CFP exam, by the way, like, everything else, like nothing is intimidating anymore. So like, I was like, nothing's intimidating and I have all this free time. And I kept noticing in client meetings and stuff, like stuff about tax came up like every meeting and we didn't know what to say. Sometimes like the most like regurgitated response from a financial planner is like, oh, you should ask your tax advisor about that, or you should ask your tax preparer about that. And I got really tired of saying that. I got really tired of hearing it. So I was like, well, I'd like to learn about tax so that like in meetings, we can just ask me, hopefully. Like that was at least the goal
whether that ended up happening, like that was at least my initial goal. So I was like, well, what is the most like efficient way that I can learn about taxes? And like be forced to learn it because I know I'm not going to learn this stuff on my own. So there's this designation called the IRS Enrolled Agent. You'll see EA. Most tax preparers are either CPAs or EAs. The CPA is kind of inefficient because it actually covers like four main areas. Only one of them is tax. So most CPAs, like they have all this knowledge that they never use, and they only study tax a quarter of the time when they study for their exams. The EA is basically just the tax part, like stripped out. And in fact, it's probably like expanded upon a bit more than the CPA is, at least on the tax side. So it's three exams. The first exam is individuals. The second exam is businesses. And the third exam is like other like regulatory stuff. The first exam, most people can pass, I'd say, because it's like we see it all the time at work. If you've done your own tax return, you've seen this stuff before. The business side was super hard because we never see it, basically. Not as common stuff. So that was pretty hard. And then the third exam is like, I don't know. It's hard but passable. So I did the EA just to like be the tax person here in-house. What did that really mean, though? That means that whenever there's like some random tax question that a client has, my boss just says, oh, well, Brian's a tax guy. We'll just have him look into it. So like that's essentially all that happened now. And then just by simply wearing the tax hat, I now all of a sudden have all these opportunities that are given to me, to work through these things when before I probably wouldn't have those opportunities.
We were talking a little bit beforehand about, you know, finding where the firm's interest lies and the employee's interest lies. And so it seems like there's a clear overlap there with
right. What
you wanted and what was good for your firm as well.
I think the EA was just something that like I proposed, something that I could sense that the firm needed. And I was like, well, this was my opportunity to sort of step up and like have a deeper like footprint into the firm and what it needs. When it comes to like the firm's interests and the employee's interest, sometimes they're like totally off though. You know, like I think when I first started though, I wanted to do this kind of a random designation, which was like a charitable planning like degree, like a graduate certificate that. And I only knew about it because like Texas Tech did it and I had already taken a couple of like graduate courses in it. So I was like kind of halfway there. So I wanted to do it further. But like then I would get the knowledge and it would have nothing to do with our clients. So like I had to find like, okay, is this worth it? Is this totally a waste of time? And just figuring that out. Like sometimes it's hard to make the case for the firm. But if the general consensus is like, okay, you can study for this designation, and if like 50% of it will help the firm, then it's probably a good decision.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about this idea of management, because I know this is something that you definitely care about a lot. Of what does it look like to be a good manager, and what does that mean for new planners?
Yeah, so management is like this thing, this idea in our industry that just isn't talked about. And it is, but it's not like this deep science that it should be. If we look at other disciplines like the legal field or the accounting field or basically any other field, like it's a thing. Management is a thing. It's totally normal, you know, like accounting firms have been in existence and you've got the monster big four now, and they have all these partners and they are continually cycling through like next gen employees and building them up. And it's like this full cycle thing. It's very normal. Law firms are doing it too. And for some reason in the fee only RIA world, we're having a hard time like just letting go and accepting the fact that management is needed and good management is needed. And it's really just okay, well, what is that? Management to me is identifying you've got a new hire. Great. What are we going to do with them? And really like figuring out who this person is, what is their personality? What are they excited about this job? What are they good at? What are they bad at? And finding a place for them in the firm, so that like this new person that you hired and you placed is happy because you're giving them projects that are exciting them. They're sticking around, you're listening to them, and you're finding like a very thoughtful place in the firm for them. I say that because the more common path is an entrepreneur builds his business up. They'll build their business up. They will reach a point where they're like, oh shoot, I have a need. I don't like doing paperwork. I need to find somebody to do my paperwork. And the job is like the job outline is already there for them. Like it is already predetermined. They just need to fill the spot, basically. And that's kind of it. And I see it a lot. I see it with people who are just learning how to delegate for the first time. A lot of solo advisors, which is a majority of our industry, they're trying to delegate because that's what they're told. Like, if I want to be the next Tim Ferriss of our industry, I need to learn how to delegate and delegate everything. That's great because you're giving somebody a job, which is cool because now you're paying an employee. But are you developing that person? Is this person happy with that job that you gave them? Are they busy enough? And are you slowly stretching them out to become like the best professional that they want to be? And it's a totally different mindset. Are you a delegator or are you a manager who's truly developing somebody?
Well, and just that experience for the employee, like, are you just expected to get a list of tasks done? Or, you know, we talk about diversity and, you know, do you as the managing, you know, as a manager, view the person that you hired as somebody who's going to make your team they're not just going to complete that task, but they're going to make your team better, especially if you manage them well.
Right. Yeah. The ultimate hire, I'd say, is you want to find somebody who, let's say me. It's me who I'm a manager for the first time, and I hire a new person, and they come in and they're like, all right, I'll do whatever. What do you want me to do? I'm going to give them a bunch of tasks and stuff, but the optimal hire for me is somebody that I can sit, I can close the door with, and I can say, all right, I just gave you a bunch of tasks. What do you like and what do you not like? And then they'll tell me like, I like this and I don't like this. And then I'll say, okay, well, what do you want to do more of? Is there anything that we can be doing better? And the optimal person has thought about it and will tell me a really open and vulnerable, honest answer. And every time I can get a vulnerable and honest answer from that person, then I can adapt and I can morph their experience and listen to what they're saying and basically make their experience better based on what they've just told me. And when somebody's new, you want to be doing that like every couple weeks or every like month, because there's so much like raw data there that they can give you. All you have to do is listen. But then like after you listen, like you have to actually do what they're requesting, which is a whole other thing. But like the first step is just like listening like a lot to these new people, because they'll tell you what they want.
Yeah. So, okay. So as a manager, when you're saying all of this, how do you balance, like, what does the firm need? I mean, because you need somebody to fill out the paperwork and get the client to sign it. Like, I mean, like that's the need of it. Like you need somebody to, you know, the classic example of like take out the trash, you know, and things like that. How do you balance between what the firm needs and then what does the employee want to do?
That's a good question. So when I went to Texas Tech again, and in that program, they preach a couple things. Like, number one, you're going to get a job and it's going to be awesome. Number two, when you're interviewing for jobs, like make sure you're doing like, make sure you're going to be doing like real planning work. Like you don't get coffee, you don't get all, you don't do the grunt work. Like you don't do that. You're training to be a financial planner. You want a job to where you're doing that. And I heard that and I was like, well, that's just baloney. It's like, there's like, somebody's got to take out the trash. Like if I don't have a trash person, like somebody's got to do those things. And I knew full and well that if I'm being hired as the only employee of the entire business, like I'm probably going to be doing those things. Like it's probably going to be me. You know, for years, I'd just be talking to other like advisors and they say, oh, how many people in your firm? I was like, oh, there's two of us. They say, oh, there's two of you. That's it. I was like, yeah, I'm the first hire. And they say, well, you have like an admin person, right? And I was like, well, I'm pretty admin-y. Like I'm pretty good with that. I answer the phones. That's me. You know, you should see me around holiday time. Like we'll do like Christmas presents or like holiday presents. And I like literally drive in my car like to clients' houses and I like drop it off like Santa's little helper. Like I do all that stuff, but I fully knew that I was getting into that stuff. So the perfect like hire comes in and knows that they're going to be doing some of that stuff. In fact, they want to do that stuff because it's just like, it's just a task. Like, let's just get it done. So the perfect person like wants to do the dirty work, but they ask for the glamorous work. So I'll say it again, I guess, because that's very tweet worthy.
Yeah.
It's like they will do the dirty work, but they'll ask for the glamorous work, which is kind of, I mean, I say this because it's what I did. So like, it's the only thing that I can speak to, but I knew that there was just so much like stuff that needed to get done. Like somebody had to do the scans and the shredding and somebody had to do the scheduling of meetings and calling back people and calling Schwab all day. Like somebody's got to do that. And I figured it was going to be me, but I want it to be me because now I know how a firm really works and I can do it all.
I very much had the same experience. And, you know, in talking to some of my peers, you know, it was very, I had just a different perspective because I knew the inner workings, or they didn't know the paperwork process because they always had somebody else do it.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It's huge. I think like you're not going to be a paperwork person. And it's like, well, then I don't know how to do paperwork. So like, why would I want to do that?
Yep.
There's a lot of value to knowing how to do paperwork.
Tons of value. Like I still fall back on that skill. Yeah. Oh, so you wrote an article on your Millennial Planners blog about managing people.
Right.
A lot of people have read that article, I assume, or I hope I should say that. Yeah. But you talk about, you know, expectations on that. So for new planners coming into this profession, into some of these smaller RIAs, what are fair expectations for them to have?
In that article, in that little section about expectations, I think the sub-bullet of that section is called like fair expectations. Like that's the first thing that needs to happen. The expectations need to be fair for the new hire that's coming in. I gave a little story in that. It was a real story of one of my friends. Ironically, you've interviewed this person. I'm not going to say who it is, but you've actually interviewed this person before. And she's one of my friends. She's a super, it's a girl because I said she already, but she's a super smart cookie. And she could have had like so many jobs. And she had like multiple job offers, I'm pretty sure. And so she had to choose, okay, which job do I want? And she chose the job that basically sold her on like the biggest dream. It was like a, I want to say national brand. Like it's a firm you've probably heard of. They were opening a new office somewhere. I think they just acquired like an office. And so like they needed her to like go in and like be the associate there. So like that was probably a pretty exciting opportunity because like, it's kind of like me. I'll be the number two in the office and get to run this thing. That was the expectation, which was a lot different than reality. Because what happened when she got there? She got there and moved away from her family. She didn't know anybody, no support system, kind of like me when I moved out here, like totally on your own. She was basically like a, I don't want to say like a glorified secretary. I think she just like was treated as the secretary. That's too far on the dirty work side. That's a little too far. And she was promised something that she didn't get. in that case, like her expectations weren't met and she quit, and she rightfully so. So that's like the biggest lesson, like for me, just watching her. And, you know, she called me after and like told me about it. And I just like, it's not fair because like, she's so good. I didn't like what happened to her. So it was like, just like a big lesson for me. What I took from that is, you know, when we get people in here, I don't want to oversell them on like how glamorous this place is. Like when I talk to a new person, I want to tell them everything that would make them not want to take this job. And if they still want it in there, they're the best person. I think we've got a lot of good things going on here, but like there are some downsides. There's downsides to every job. You're going to come in here and you're not going to have an office. And we share office space with an ad agency right now. So like, they're a lot of fun to share office space with, but sometimes they're loud. Can you handle that? You're going to be doing the paperwork and you're going to be doing the scans. You're doing the dirty work. Is that okay with you? Like, not so much like underselling, but like just letting it be real. Like, this is what it's really going to be like, and not this like pie in the sky, please work for me desperately sort of, I don't know. I don't want to say lie, but that's kind of what happened to my friend.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, there's so many, gosh, that's far too common of a story. And, you know, it's when you have those realistic expectations set out for you, or whatever your expectations are going into the job, it's if those aren't being met, you know, then you have a decision point. Like, do you want to stay there or do you need to be looking for another job?
It is common and it's sad.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that, I have friends who, they will say that they're still, you know, they stayed at their job too long, you know, not knowing when to move or when to do that. You know, you really, I hate to be cynical about this, but you're the person who's going to care about your career the most. And you kind of have to take ownership of that.
Agreed. But job at the same time, job hunting sucks. It is, it is such a drag. So like, of course you can like feel some dissonance there when somebody doesn't want to do it. I can feel for them too. It's tough.
Absolutely. Yeah. You had mentioned that you hired somebody now. So how has your perspective changed when you now have somebody who you're managing?
That is a great question. So when I first became a manager for the first time, we had like this internship program that we've been doing for a couple years now. And when my first year running the intern program, after 2 weeks, like some like really small amount of time, like I just wanted to like write my boss like the longest like handwritten letter and just say like, dude, I am sorry. Like I'm just thinking about it, that time, because I just wanted to like commend him for how much patience he had with me. And I know I was slow and I know I messed up and I know I did all those things, and he never made me feel the way that I wanted to make this intern feel, which was like, what are you doing? I just told you this. I just told, like, I never got like chewed out like that when I totally could have and probably should have. So immediately what happened becoming a manager for like 2 weeks is that I felt this immediate amount of like empathy towards my current manager, and just like thankfulness. And I appreciated the patience that they have, because it's a totally different perspective. You know, I totally made being a manager for the first time made me a better employee, which is like mind blowing, but I finally got it. Like, I finally understood why we would plan so many days in advance for XYZ. I would understand why he wanted me to present things in a certain way as opposed to the other way. Just like how to manage my time, how to manage my own calendar and someone else's calendar. Like, it took an insanely short amount of time to appreciate what had been happening to me for like 2 or 3 years. All when I became a manager for the first time. So it was like that perspective shift was huge. So I totally recommend, if you are like in your first like couple years of doing this job and you're finally get your stride down and you think I'm a good associate and I'm good at meeting preps and all, I highly recommend that you make the case to your manager to like, hey, can we do an internship program? And like, can I be the supervisor of that? Because it will change your perspective on everything.
You know, it's like this natural progression of a career, right? Like you do the work and then you start managing people doing the work. And that's a different perspective. Mm-hmm. Are you on partner track right now?
Yeah. So let's see, what happened in our firm? I think when I first got hired on, we were both taking that calculated risk on each other. Like we kind of didn't know what was about to happen. Or at least I didn't know what was about to happen. But I had high hopes, you know. I was going to make a leap for something long-term or at least semi-long-term just to make it all worth it. And I don't know what my boss's like plans were for me, but I know he's a good manager. And when I say good manager, he put a lot of time and energy into developing me. So really like a lot of time, like making sure I understood things, giving me opportunities to run meetings, giving me opportunities to, you know, those first times when I were running meetings without him in there, like all those things that I needed the opportunity to do so. He was giving me these opportunities to do so. So my career like jumped like way quicker than it probably should have. And he was doing it on purpose because he had a high degree of faith in me, which was great. And what eventually he's kind of developed me into is like this person who could invariably be a junior partner, like basically at this point now, and we're like 4.5 years in. So I'm 4.5 years in, and I think like even starting about 6 months ago, we just had our first conversations around potentially buying into this business, which is another word for partnership or equity ownership, if you will. So we just started those conversations like, I don't know, half a year ago, and we're pushing the envelope. We're pushing forward on that right now. So it's all kind of happening.
Well, it'll be so interesting. You know, you talked about the difference of being a manager, how that made you be a better employee. I'm wondering how like that business owner will change, you know, your perspective yet again.
Yeah. And I'm sure that's a conversation you've had a couple times with people here on this podcast. With another Yesky Booby person with Lauren. She's probably pushing forward on that, on her partnership track, which she's been on since she basically started. She was hired on, like, I think on the quote unquote partnership track that they have there at Yesky Booby. And I think a couple others are on there as well. But I think now that like, especially with like Yusuf and stuff, like I think now it's becoming more real that partnership is happening. I talked to Yusuf right after that announcement, and he said immediately there was this shift like in his mind to where like, okay, this is my thing. Like this is my business. I think we were on our way to a something. We were managing or getting around near a conference. And I think they like took like an Uber. And he was like, it's on the business. And he was like, oh, wait, it's on me. Maybe we shouldn't take this Uber. Just like little things like that. It was immediate. It wasn't even real yet. He hadn't signed any papers yet, but it was immediate. So I'm looking forward to seeing how it happens too.
You talked a lot about finding your people and like finding your tribe. So what are the other places where you've gone to really find your people as you've continued in your career?
The study group has been great. That was great, but study groups are kind of like bands. They form, they have a great run, and then they kind of fizzle out for whatever reason. It's just like, it is what it is. That's what study groups are. So I was kind of like looking for a new band, basically. And fortunately, like I've been around the FPA community for like a while. And so FPA, like next gen, like this group has really been core for me. But there's a few different ways you can go within the next gen community. Like it's grown that much. I first got exposed to like the next gen sort of movements, like 3 or 4 years ago. I ended up winning a scholarship to like the next gen gathering. And I'm so glad I did. Because like, if I didn't get the scholarship, I probably wouldn't have gone. And just like, it wasn't a cost I felt comfortable asking for me, because I didn't really understand what it was. Like, what is this? Is this a conference? Is this like a powwow? What is this? So I'm glad I won the scholarship, because then I got to go. It was in Dallas at the time, which is my hometown. So I got to like see my dad like around Father's Day. So that was perfect. So I got to go. And when I was there, I was like, oh my gosh, like this is my people. Like, this is it. Like, this is where everybody is who is just like me, trying to do the same things I'm trying to do. And this is where they all meet and just talk. So Next Gen Gathering kind of like set it off for me. So like, if you're on the cusp and you think you've got a great story, I recommend applying for that scholarship. And if you don't get the scholarship, you can still go for super cheap, because it's like a low budget thing. It's totally tangible, honestly. So that was huge. And there's other like FPA things that sort of happened for me. I ended up running the FPA of San Francisco, like Next Gen community for like a couple of years, and I'm finally phased out now. But like running that and like being the face of that little group, has been huge for me, because I was ended up being like a person that people called on. I got to go to board members, or I got to be a board member and go to like those meetings, and just like, we would throw events and people would be thanking me for the event when really like I wasn't really the one putting on. It was like our crew, and just like being like the person that people would ask, you know, how does this Next Gen thing work? What is it? And just like spreading the word on that. So being involved with that group was like a whole other tribe. And then I could meet other people who were on the partnership track and talk to them and just be fully immersed in this industry and like the best people who are doing it.
How is your work connecting you to your purpose, your community, and your values? I'm Kate Healy, Managing Director of Generation Next at TD Ameritrade. And we believe that independent registered investment advisors have the power to impact the world in profound ways. If you've never considered being an RIA, it's time to take a look. There's no better way to put your skills and knowledge to work for the greater good of your clients, your community, and your own future. Find out more at tdainstitutional.com.
If you like this episode, you can find more at fpaactivate.org, and be sure to join the FPA Activate community on Facebook. It's a growing study group for financial planning professionals, from students to firm owners, professors, and board members. You'll find them all there, where you too can lend your voice. We hope you'll join us and help grow the financial planning profession. Thanks for listening.